You're listening to the Partially Examined Life, a philosophy podcast by some folks who at one point set on doing philosophy for a living but then thought better of it. Our question for episode 42 is, how does human nature, and specifically moral psychology, vary by sex? And we've read the first three chapters of Carol Gilligan's In a Different Voice from 1982, and also Charlotte Perkins Gilman's novel, Her Land, from 1915. My name is Mark Lintonmeyer, running on girl power in Madison, Wisconsin.
This is Seth Paskin, parthenogenically replicating in Austin, Texas.
This is Dylan Casey just sitting around in Middleton, Wisconsin.
And this is Azura Crispino enjoying a beautiful sunset in Parker, Colorado.
Very nice. So, wow, this is a historic event. First of all, welcome back, Seth. You've been gone for so long.
Yay!
Thank you so much. I can't tell you how thrilled I am to be doing this as opposed to what I have been doing for the last couple of months.
And do you wish to reveal any of that, or should we just pass over that
in silence? Let's pass over it in silence.
Okay.
I have smeared the blood of the lamb above my door, if you will, to let the angel pass over.
But just to clarify, your absence for the last four episodes does not mean that you're going to be intermittent. You were just gone, and now you're back.
That is correct.
And you might be surprised to hear Dylan for the third episode in a row, people. But we'll say no more about that, other than we really like having Dylan around. And Wes has not quit. He will be back. But he just didn't want to do this one. And our star this evening, Azura, welcome back.
It's a pleasure.
Longtime listeners will remember Azura from our second Kant episode, Kant on Knowledge, well over a year ago. And the reason that we had gotten in touch with you in the first place, right, was to find somebody who knew something about feminism. So this has been in the works for a long time.
Yes, it has.
And the readings that we did this time were eventually selected by Azura after I harassed her for months and months and then selected Her Land. And then I read that whole thing and said, that's not enough for a discussion. So, and you had said, but the Gilligan was extremely influential on your development, right?
Well, we had thrown out a lot of different ideas and there were various different constraints. So I'm not sure that I would say that I actually made the final decision. But I mean, I think we came together in a consensus kind of way to do that. But one of the reasons...
That's such a gender-specific way to characterize that.
It's very Herlandish.
That's right. Mark was trying to give you absolute credit and you contextualized it.
So this is how it's going to be.
No, I think that's an interesting point. But part of the reason why I really like Carol Gilligan's In a Different Voice is that one of the major questions that I think comes up a lot when people are trying to get into feminism is this idea of to what extent are these differences inherent and to what extent are these differences culturally constructed? And I fall more into the culturally constructed camp. And what I like about Gilligan's work is that she does a really good job of talking about, I think, how girls and women think about these ideas conceptually differently, but she's really context in this perspective of, on one hand, that girls are raised differently in the sense that they have this closer female parent and then they develop differently. So anyway, I just thought that it would be a good foundation for us to discuss, especially because care ethics is such a big branch. And then Her Land, I really like because the three of you are men, and I wanted to give you sort of a way to think about what it would be like to be a woman absent the thought of man. And that's what Gilligan is really exploring in part that I found particularly valuable.
You mean Gilman.
Did I just do that again?
We're going to have this trouble the entire time. We picked two authors that have nearly identical names. Should we just call them Carol and Charlotte?
No, that's no better.
So yes, there's many, many branches. We wanted to do something on feminism from the start of this. I know that the parts that I studied of that in grad school were more in the sort of neo-Marxist continental camp of once you understand Marxism and understand moral relativism and some of the crazy existentialist stuff, feminism seems to branch right out of that. Kristeva, right, being the main figure mm-hmm. there. But this is not that. This should be easier for our listeners to get a handle on and won't require the background of folks that we have not yet done episodes on. So maybe we'll get to that harder stuff later. Neither of these is officially a work of philosophy, right? I mean, they're both studied in philosophy classes, but one's a novel by Gilman and she was a sociologist.
I don't know which version of the book you guys read.
Of Her Land?
Of Her Land, yeah. But the one I have is actual hardback. And the introduction by this woman, Anne Lane, is actually quite extensive and goes into some detail about her life. She's very interesting.
That's a good place to start, that we'll talk about her and we'll talk about Her Land a bit. It's more dramatic than the Gilligan, and it can get some of these themes out there.
So she was born in 1860 She's somehow related in a kind of extended way to the Beechers, Harriet Beecher Stowe and Henry Ward Beecher. Mm. That family is somehow related to her father. And they were very poor. She had a brother and they grew up in a very poor home and moved frequently when they were kids. She got married sort of reluctantly and after the marriage became deeply depressed and consulted a well-known Philadelphia neurologist who specialized in women's nervous disorders. So at the time, the cure was a rest cure to basically put you into isolation, remove all reading, writing, that sort of thing. It almost made her go insane, and she rejected it and then fled to California, abandoning essentially her husband and the child that they had had. She got much better in California. She tried to reconcile with her husband. It didn't work. So they got a divorce, and she got the daughter and moved to California. Long story short is she stayed out there. She did some writing. So she wrote something called The Yellow Wallpaper, which mm-hmm. was an autobiographical story of a woman who basically has a mental breakdown. And this brought her some notoriety, and she ended up getting involved in women's associations and literary circles and so forth on the West Coast.
And I had read that in, I think, a horror anthology.
Yeah.
The wallpaper is really creepy. Maybe it's haunted.
The author of the introduction says it could be placed in the tradition of black comedy, although its comic quality has not been previously acknowledged.
Very black.
Yes. Anyway, she became quite involved and outspoken in women's rights. At one point, she was attacked because she had abandoned her child. After that, she kind of left California and just traveled around the country, lecturing and being a part of activities and so forth. It was kind of out of that activity that she wrote another apparently more famous book than her land called Women in Economics. And she got some international notoriety for that. For the rest of her life, she was quite prolific as a writer, writing both fiction and nonfiction. When she was about 40, she married one of her cousins and they lived together for some time until he died. And then she died shortly thereafter.
And she did not breed with her cousin.
No, no. I suspect it was probably one of those very upper class, East Coast, arranged marriage type situations.
It would have been very in keeping with her love of controlled breeding to keep those genes, those Gilman genes, yes, strong, or the Perkins genes.
And apparently during her lifetime, she was extremely well known, had a great amount of infamy as well as fame. And then a generation later was completely forgotten.
Well, in this book from 1915, right?
Correct.
Appeared in serial form in a magazine she published herself, Forerunner. There's actually a sequel to Our Land that I did not look at. It kind of reads like an H.G. Wells novel.
It's awesome.
Like Journey to the Center of the Earth.
Azuris, thank you for sharing this with us because I enjoyed reading it so much. It does read exactly like one of those turn of the century science fiction adventure kind of stories. It was so much in that style. It was pure enjoyment.
I'm glad.
Of course, if you're reading it just for the philosophical content, you can skip the first third.
Because that's the best part.
It's just the... And then our plane we're climbing mountains. And as Azura had said before, the point of this is that this is a lost society of just women. All the men were killed off.
By their own demise, right?
Yeah.
The important part.
Yeah.
Most of them, weren't they killed off by a volcano or something? But then just the ones that were slaves were left. And they were just obnoxious and tried to take over. And so they were all killed off.
Right.
As opposed to just keeping a couple around for breeding. So that just shows you that those women just did not have foresight.
You need to set the stage a little bit better than that, Mark.
Go for it, Seth.
So this is a utopian novel. Like all utopian novels, you have to have some kind of an origin story for how you come across this isolated civilization that somehow manages to keep itself distinct. These three guys are adventuring, and the guide tells them of this mysterious land that nobody goes, where there are only women. And they, of course, don't believe it's true. The whole concept is that this thing is sort of elevated up in this remote mountain range, and it's sort of sealed off from the rest of the world by the mountain range. And the origin story is that at one point there was a pass that was open down to the lower lands, but at one point there was a war going on between the lowlanders and the highlanders, and all of the men of this highland village were down fighting the lowlanders, and a volcano erupted and sealed off the pass so that only the women and the miscellaneous few slaves at the time were open. And this was 2,000 years ago. So they've had 2,000 years of living without men in this isolated utopia.
But you have to explain the origin of them continuing on, right?
That is correct. I will be happy to, but I don't want to monopolize the conversation.
Oh, it's not a conversation yet. Go ahead.
Well, as you said, the men essentially die out or are killed. And the women who are there resign themselves to basically living out the remainder of their natural lives until everybody is dead. Then a miracle happens, and you'll have to read the book to get the details. But essentially, one woman miraculously gets pregnant and gives birth to a girl.
I want to put a hiccup in that because I think that it's important, at least in terms of the context of the point of view about science, which I don't know that we should really talk in detail about in the book. But the woman who has the first child, Gilman writes about it as a kind of evolution, a parthenogenic birth that had very Darwinian undertones of the kinds of things that happen to other sorts of animals if they're left in isolation. It was not divine in the sense of immaculate conception, that is a impregnation by a deity or something like that. That kind of thing. It's wholly within the physical being of this woman that this happens.
Yes, and I apologize if that's the way it came across. What I meant to say was it was taken as such by the community because the religion of the society is like an earth mother sort of basis. They revered this Ur mother as a divine, what, closer to the divine maybe is what I'm looking for. She doesn't characterize the society as viewing the woman as evolutionarily superior. That to me is something that comes out later over time.
And I can see I'm looking at the Wikipedia page for parthenogenesis here, and it says, in many cases, parthenogenesis occurs when one gender, typically the male, is unavailable in the general vicinity. Once males are again available, the parthenogenesis created females would be capable of mating with the males and creating normal offspring. Apparently, this does happen in some kinds of animals. It can sort of turn on and off.
That's pretty weird.
It is weird, but it's true.
So this is what she was thinking of, at least, in putting this forward.
Yes. So this original mother has a girl child, and then she proceeds to have four more girl children. And then those five girl children each proceed to have five girl children, and so on and so forth. And kind of the original people that are there die off, and all you're left with is this one branch of parthenogenically replicating mothers.
Who, strangely enough, are not all identical twins.
No,
but
no, they are not.
She didn't know that much genetics.
And so when these guys climb this mountain, these three adventurers, and they get up into this society, they encounter this relatively homogenous utopian society that's 100% women who reproduce parthenogenically and have been doing so for thousands of years and have created this utopian society.
But since you're talking about breeding, that part of this is they don't just have five kids, they can control it. They sort of have some special feeling that they know that it's going to happen. And if they involve themselves in a lot of other activities or something like that, then they won't.
But that comes after the period of time where they run up against the limit of their resources. So they voluntarily control. They realize they can voluntarily control the number of children. So in fact, not all of them have children, but most of them do. But you only have one.
Right.
And it's only a rare few that get to have two, et cetera, et cetera.
Right. And that becomes the key mechanism of social control, right? Not only have they developed customs and actually social aspects, but just if somebody just seems to be less than optimal in some way, then that person does not breed.
That is correct.
Well, Azura, where should we take this next?
Well, so one of the things that I thought was really interesting in the beginning of the book is when the three adventurers are trying to speculate as to what a society only made up of women will be like. The thought is that women, as that word is being used right now, understand each other relationally towards men, right? That to be a woman means to try to be attractive to a man, and that this requires all sorts of actions and ways of being and ways of dressing and so on and so forth. And what I think Gilman does a really good job of doing is to set up the expectation from the two male adventurers of this is what these women are going to be like. And then she completely shatters that impression as soon as they actually arrive at her land, which I think is philosophically relevant.
Exactly along those lines, it's interesting that the whole point of view of the novel is written as a kind of travelogue from the point of view of one of the male adventurers. And in fact, it's never told from the point of view of any of the women in her land. It's always told from the point of view of these men, and you have in particular the narrator, Van, and his two compatriots, and they each represent pretty clear stereotypical styles of men, you know, a kind of manly man in Terry and a kind of, I don't know, more effeminate man in Jake. And then Van seems to me like something like Gilman's idea of an educable man that would, you know, listen and still be a man in some respects. I guess learn something. I guess that's the big thing. He is of the three. He's the one that seems to be the one who actually genuinely changes his mind.
And we could make comparisons and say which of the men correspond to which of us, but we won't do that.
No.
But, I mean, I think Azura's point was, in the opening part of the book, they're speculating about what a society of women would be like, and they're thinking, there can't be a society without men, because women are incapable of rationally discoursing and coming to agreement, that they're too catty or they're too passive. They kind of go through all these different modalities because they're thinking of the society women or the women of their class in the society they come from. And they're trying to imagine these women who live in some degree of luxury and are responsible for maintaining the home and having kids and them being catty with each other about others. And women don't operate in the public sphere of politics and economics and commerce and academia and all those sorts of things. So they can't imagine a society that's run by women because they can't imagine women in those roles.
It's always fun reading a social commentary aimed at a different age that you can have a little distance that, you know, it might have been an accurate representation that women were so marginalized at the time that she was writing that, yeah, she probably thought that most of the people in her social class who were women were very frivolous. You know, that's one of the ongoing themes in her work, that even when women are treated well and supported, they're not given any responsibility and they're just, they're not built up into being impressive people to the detriment of everyone.
Right.
Well, and I think part of what she's trying to say is that the reason why the women are so frivolous and so on and so forth is because they have been so marginalized that their only option is to be able to attract a man. And in order to attract a man, all of this frivolity is now necessary. Because when we get to her land, there's this comment about, well, why would I wear a hat with feathers in it? You know, that's ridiculous. Mm-hmm. You know, I need to be running around and climbing trees and being active and doing all of these things. I wanted to come back to the point about this being a travel log, because Gilligan talks about this too in her first chapter, this idea that when girls go on an adventure, that it's a very different sort of adventure. When you think about mythology and Sleeping Beauty and Snow White, you have them falling into this deep sleep and all of this passivity. And so I think the fact that she contexts it, a male travel log adventure type story, is to sort of give the idea that these women are also themselves adventurous. But instead of their adventure being individual, it's context in the sense that the whole society is going through this adventure.
You know, another tack she could have taken, I suppose, would have been to tell the origin story of her land from the point of view of like one of the observers of that initial parthenogenesis or something like that. You know, another way to do it would have been, again, starting from the origin and go through generations of women and tell a kind of mega novel story about it, but all from the perspective of the birth of her land. She clearly chose to do it this particular way, and it's effective in the sense that you can look back and tell the story of it having fully matured. In the end, you know, the last half of the book or so is really revealing the origin story of her land, but sort of looking backwards on it in this sort of fully mature state.
Yeah, I think maybe despite the fact that we've talked about the origin here for a little while in this discussion, my initial impression was that's a storytelling device that we have to give some kind of origin, but that's not the point. The point is, what would a society be like when men are not around? Well, okay, part of that is then how could you have a society where men are not around? What would that mean? So the origin does matter in terms of we want to see what it's like, not the sudden absence of men, but really there's been a lot of development free of men, and what would that be like? And there's some details, again, like the fact that there's this genetic engineering that, oh, that woman is a little too big for her britches. Let's not let her breed. The other women saying this. There's such a social consciousness that such a woman would be made to recognize that she's not optimal as far as the breeding pool goes. That seems to be how most of these things work, right? They say some women are not optimal to be mothers. In other words, to be the full-time caretakers of children. In fact, most women are not appropriate for that. So it becomes specialized. And there's a recognition in the society that, yeah, that's the way it should be. I don't want my biological child being raised by me who is not optimally suited for doing so. I want to be able to interact with them, but I want the majority of that to go to somebody else.
So, I mean, Terry, I mean, the men in the novel answer those questions. Well, what do you do about crime? What do you do about people
people who don't agree. And Gilman includes those things, but I think that they are sort of on the edges of a primary concern, which is the idea that you have this society in which individuals have their orientation towards the whole group, and there's a kind of consensus. And of course, at the edges, you know, we only hear a little bit about what happens at the edges of this consensus. In general, the things that they bring to bear to build the society, one of them is practical science, cultivation and efficiency. They cultivate the entire plane, including the trees. You know, they breed the nuts together to figure out how to get the most efficient food production and all that kind of stuff. And they develop regimens of education and physical development so that they can, with the point of view of all flourishing together at some level. So in that perspective, one of the hardest things for them to deal with, the men, is the disposition with respect to competition. The idea that society can only proceed and grow and flourish with the whip of competition. That's the point of view of the men. And they're flabbergasted that this society doesn't have competition. And at first they think there must be competition that really pushes them along, just in a way that they're not used to seeing. And in the end, Gilman seems to put forth the notion that there is no competition, not in anything remotely like the sense in which we normally think of it, but that nonetheless the society flourishes and progresses and develops, but in the absence of anything like genuine competition, but born out of cooperative activity towards a greater good.
Right. So this is supposed to be saying ultimately something about that when philosophers have reflected on what is human nature, like Hobbes, right, everybody is selfish. They just don't have women in mind.
Yeah.
And that's chiefly what this is supposed to be about.
Well, that would be her response, that she would say it might be true for men, what Hobbes says, but that isn't the way all society has to be. And here's an example that would be completely resonant with women's psychology or point of view. I don't know how you exactly would put it, but certainly it wouldn't be the only way you had to do it. And I suspect that Gilman would think that Hobbes was just wrong about men as well, because she has these three men, and the one that would be most like a Hobbesian man would be Terry, the guy who ends up being the reason for them getting thrown out and who simply cannot control himself and also is completely befuddled by the existence of this society. Whereas the other men don't seem to fit so well into Hobbes's picture of the way in which society works. So she offers an alternative that isn't just focused on women, but also holds, seems to me, forth the notion that, well, there is a gradation of psychology among the women in her land, as well as among the three men that she takes as token representatives of maledom.
Can I go back to the food production for a second, what we were talking about with the nuts and so on?
Please do.
I think that's interesting when we think about it in terms of the question of competition. And also, we were talking about earlier how a lot of the more theoretically context of philosophical work deals with Marxism and comes out of that tradition or is inspired by that tradition, if you want to say. And so I think it's kind of interesting that, you know, here they're talking about doing small scale, high yielding in the sense that it's compact type of farming. And Gilman is talking about this really at a time before the kind of industrialized farms that we see today. But you also see in her writing a hint that women would just not make the kinds of decisions that would lead to the kind of industrial farming practices that we have today, even though she's writing 105 years ago. And I find that really sort of interesting.
When you say industrial farming, Azura, you mean the idea that you would farm for profit.
Maybe I'm reading something into Gilman that isn't there, but I did want to bring up this point that part of what feminism talks about is this idea that the relationship that you have to your environment can be either exploitative or non-exploitative. Yeah. And that part of what happens in competition and in capitalism is that you start to look at your environment in terms of how do I capitalize this asset? In other words, how do I squeeze as much out of it as possible? Not how do I do this in a way that is going to be cohesive and long going. So here she has a discussion of here's a society who's been here for 2000 years and they are having evolutions, but the kind of evolution that they're having is to have food that is going to be highly nutritious and that it all evolves together and that it's this really abundant ecosystem. They're not thinking about, oh, I want to start the next Coca-Cola. And I think that Gilman does an excellent job of expressing the values that Gilligan is later going to say are these feminine values, and saying, if we take them to their natural conclusion, what kind of picture would that say for our society, both in terms of how do we produce goods? How do we distribute goods? How do we deal with household labor? Because even this idea of, okay, I give up my child for somebody else to raise, that may seem really heartless, but I think a lot of women think to themselves, well, you know, but I also want to have a career and I want to do these other things and I want to be really involved. And how can I possibly do everything? And in her land, it's very easy. I can give it to somebody who's more suited to that task, and I can go back to, you know, genetically engineering tree nuts so that we can have this really bountiful harvest. And because it's all being done communally, I don't have to achieve that competitive status of I have to do everything.
Right. And if you give it up, it's not even completely giving it up, because really there's so much communality about it anyway, that you could still see the kid as much as the average working dad in this society would.
So the question to me would be, does Gilman's Herland admit of the kinds of criticisms that one would make of Plato's Republic? One of which would be, because of the specialization and the notion that each person has a metal soul of a particular kind that predisposes them to certain role in society, then you sort of have a neat bow around the building of society, because every person that is a piece of society has a very defined role. And then it becomes kind of a question of arranging the parts properly. That's different than saying that each person is their own activity that might realize that activity in many different ways. And in fact, following Aristotle, might realize their activity in unoptimal ways. And so does Herland admit of the criticism of Plato's Republic that, well, there's just essentially no individuality here, that any kind of individual motion, individual determination is just utterly absent. And you're either having a situation where people are effectively coerced into being into the role in society that they're in, or you have an unreasonable expectation that people will just fall into their role in a natural way and not only accept it, but actually thrive in it. That's a sort of a standard criticism of Plato, right?
To me, it's the former. And the interesting question is whether or not we believe that a society that was 100% created and run by women would be able to effectively accomplish this in a way that we don't believe it's possible in Plato, from the perspective of having men involved.
Oh, so that the third thought would be that because it's a society of women, a utopia of women, we avoid the difficulties that we would lay at the feet of Plato's Republic. That would have to be because the human nature of women is different than the human nature of men, or that Plato was wrong. It could be both.
Or potentially both, yeah. That was my reading of it anyway. Mm-hmm.
How about you, Azura?
I don't know which way I necessarily want to jump on that question, whether Gilman is saying, well, this would just not be an issue because it's a society of women. I tend to think that that's not the answer that she would give. I tend to think that the answer that she would give is that this is a society where the priorities of the society are very clear, and everybody has been indoctrinated into those priorities and accepts them to a certain point and sees the wisdom of them. But not only that, also has seen the futility of having other priorities be standard, right? Because there's this idea that they're all aware of how they came to be in this catastrophe, and that these ideals of competition and these ideals of war were the reasons why they were in this catastrophe in the first place. So then we end up having a question of, to what extent does individuation necessarily have to interlie with competition and necessarily have to interlie with war? But I see those questions as being really sort of tangential to what you were asking.
What origin of the competition would be something like jealousy or envy? The notion that you want something that somebody else has. That feature, even if you don't add into it the notion of competition, that you want to one-up somebody, just that you want something that somebody else has, it struck me that that was utterly absent in Herland.
And I think what she's envisioning is a situation not where I have to individuate myself by being better than you, but that we are all working towards making the situation better.
No, but jealousy is different than that. Jealousy would be like, just take the example of being not as fast as someone else at running. It's just clear to you that you're not as good at jumping and running as someone else, but you really want to be that way. And that to me is a perfectly normal human sense, both between men and women, of wishing that they could do something different. It's sort of the grass is greener on the other side kind of thing. And that kind of jealousy is the origin of all kinds of conflict at the bottom of it. And there isn't even that kind of jealousy at all ever represented in Herland. And that there was all kinds of things I really loved about the novel. But if there's one thing that sort of felt like, you know, this tells me this is really a utopia in which there are some really important things that are absent or evolved out of human beings. And one of them is the notion of wanting something that they don't have.
There's something to be said for when I'm in a system where I'm being exploited and I think that my resources are limited to me and that I need to claw out of the boiling pot of water, even if it means climbing over the other lobster to do so. Jealousy expresses itself in a different way. Whereas in a situation where we are freed from these exploitative pressures and the minimum requirements for society to thrive have been met, I wonder where their jealousy would be expressed and lived in a different way if you had those background conditions. So instead of my being jealous of my friend for being more beautiful than I am, well, actually, that wouldn't even matter in Herland because beauty is no longer really held as a standard in the same way. But let's say that, you know, I'm jealous of her because she can run faster than I can. I think in this system, it would be like, well, but at the same time, I'm really glad that the society has somebody who can run as fast and I can either strive to try to run faster than she can, or I can set my sights to doing something that I'm more appropriately tasked to do that is also going to be good for the society as a whole. But the jealousy would not have that character of do or die.
I think there's a certain amount of hand waving that goes on in the novel just because it's so quick in discussing some of these sections. Somebody mentioned their facility with technology in terms of agriculture and things like that. And part of this is just mastering all the natural domains, including psychology. And that goes into the education system that it's very, very carefully designed so that children sort of discover the joy of learning early and it won't seem like work at all. And then they'll just strive in all the ways that would be good for the society to have them strive just by the way they're prepped. I don't know if Gilman has to make a decision, for instance, on this specialization issue. Does the shoemaker have to stay a shoemaker? Or if she has a midlife crisis, can she shift to being a nut gatherer or something else? That's something that their expertise about psychology would allow them to deal with optimally. The important thing is that they are supremely rational
Yes.
in dealing with these things, and they're extremely adaptable. That even this whole signing on to what society's goals are, well, she mentions that all the laws are constantly being remade. There's no respect for tradition or for the elder, you know, what ancestors did. Everything is constantly being rethought to made optimal to current conditions. So that would seem to make it seem like less of a sacrifice to sort of sign on to what society wants, because you are part of society actively molding these things in a rational way, responding to conditions on the ground.
One thing that Gilligan talks about in a different voice is that she talks about this idea that boys and girls develop differently, and that for boys, the process of individuation is more important, or not more important, but that it happens differently than the process of individuation from girls. And I kind of read her into saying that that was in part because it's the female primary caretaker, and so it's easier for boys to individuate themselves away from the mother than it is from a girl to individuate herself away from the mother. That all having been said, I wonder if maybe for Gilman, the process of individuation and how that would lead to conflict was less of a major concern if we take this idea that there is this feminine underlying way of looking at things that may be in the mix.
You mentioned, Azura, that Gilligan talks about the daughter's relationship to the mother. As a caregiver, the male view is that it prohibits her from developing individuation in the way that men do, right? A more charitable reading would be to say that it creates a different sense of individuation than male children have, right? And she goes into all that stuff about Freud and all the rest of the psychoanalytic theory, seeing women's development as deficient. But the other thing that we have to note, and I didn't want to bring this up, but we kind of have to acknowledge it, is that Gilman, in addition to being a feminist, was also a socialist. And inherent in this concept of the way that Herland operates is that women rationally would essentially choose a path, if you will, or create a society that itself was more socialistic as opposed to, for example, capitalistic or whatever the alternative.
Individualistic.
Individualistic, yes.
Those two points, we see those both in Hobbes, that human nature is everybody's selfish. And based on that rationality, if you are acting rationally, you are pursuing your self-interest. If you're going to have a society that makes sense, it has to acknowledge those two basic facts, that everybody is selfish and that rationality, therefore, equals following your self-interest. And that's exactly opposed to what's going on here, that not only are we not inherently selfish, and you can hear more about that in our Pat Churchland episode, our last episode, that apparently the mechanisms that allow us to care for ourselves, the neural mechanisms, are the same exact mechanisms that allow us to extend this care to others. And that's so far back in evolution, that's not a matter of human development. That's just every human being that is not completely deformed is not going to be selfish in this basic way. And in fact, I think Gilman is going to say that for us to be driven into selfishness is, like Azura was saying, because we're being subjected to some horrible situation. If we were in some sort of rational society in the first place, we would not develop this kind of sense of selfishness. That far from that being human nature, that's a perversion based on the exploitative nature of what's going on around us.
I like that.
Yeah.
Wait, hold on for a second. Does this conclude with us saying that wanting what somebody else has is a perversion of human nature?
Wanting what somebody else has is not the same as being overridden by jealousy, right? I mean, I can want what somebody else has, and that can motivate me to become a better person, that can push me to excellence.
Not for a two-year-old, right? Correct me if I'm wrong, but you're saying that proper education will educate out jealousy. There's many ways in which you can get something that you don't have. One would be to improve yourself so that you can attain that. Another would be to take it. Are we saying that the motive to take something is a perversion of human nature?
I must revise what I just said, because Gilman thinks that for them to have gotten to this point required a lot of selective breeding over time.
Yes.
So, no. The fact that she admits genetic manipulation, and there's another book that I'll point readers at if you want to know more explicitly what the sociological views of Charlotte Perkins Gilman are behind her land. There's another thing on Project Gutenberg I saw, Our Androcentric Culture or The Man-Made World. And in that book, she's very explicit about her being okay with genetic engineering, with eugenics. And I know that could make us just sort of discount her, but for her time, that was not at all unusual. We had not yet had World War II and somebody trying to put this into effect. A liberal in America could have this view and not be crazy. It had not yet been so thoroughly debunked at that point. But give it, if you have that view that eugenics is okay, then well, what is human nature anyway? Human nature is sort of whatever we evolve it to be.
Well, you might not even be a eugenicist and believe that, right? You just have to be an evolutionist to believe that. A eugenicist would say that you want to select it on purpose, the way you select pigeons for being poofy-throated or being long-beaked or dogs being Great Danes or being Cocker Spaniels. You know, if you breed dogs together and you just leave them to their own devices, you'll get the same looking dog eventually, just like you'll get the same looking pigeon. And it's only by selection that you get a variety of dog breeds or a variety of pigeon breeds. And you know, that's been known for a long, long time and is some of the origins of Darwin's first account of evolution. So the notion that you would have natural selection versus human selection, seems to me a eugenicist would be somebody who believed in active human-based selection of human genetics.
Yes, which is what she was.
As opposed to an evolutionist that would say, well, there's a natural progression. It seems to me that the Gilligan comes in here. Maybe, I don't know if this is exactly what Azura was thinking, but I was thinking about jealousy. I was also thinking about the question of making mistakes and having regrets. One of the main themes in Gilligan's book is interviewing these women regarding their decisions about abortions that they had or were going to have or thought about having, and the complexity of that problem for them and the way in which they thought it through. And some of them had an abortion and they felt like it was a mistake, and others that they didn't, and how they all dealt with that. It seems to me also the notion of making mistakes and having regrets is also related to jealousy and wishing you had something you didn't have. And again, the question of how you act on that, maybe that's what's at issue. But I'm just wondering where we're imagining the role, or Gilman's imagining the notion of the differences between men and women about the manifestations of these kinds of things. jealousy and regrets with mistakes and stuff like that.
Yeah, so definitely part of the conversation that I was trying to bring to the table in picking these books was to try to get to this idea of how different are men and women in their moral decision making or in their moral thinking, or even just in general, how different are they? You're talking about this idea of making mistakes and regrets and how that's related to jealousy. And I'm trying to think about how that's related to exploitation and how that maybe would work out.
Say something more about exploitation.
Exploitation basically means that your choices are not your own, or the types of choices that you're making are skewed in one direction or another, that you don't fully have autonomy over your decisions. And I would add, in the case of women, that often there is an exploitative force of household labor. So even in situations where you have husbands and wives that are both working full-time jobs, women are still doing between 70 and 80% of all of the household labor in those kinds of relationships. And that's in our country where we think that things are pretty good. Well, what does that mean for an individual woman if she's spending, let's say, 25% as much time as her husband in household labor tasks? That means that she's not working on her novel. That means that she's not writing her hit song.
So exploitation, just so I can understand, someone who's being exploited is someone who does not have the normal constraints to their autonomy that most people have. Because everybody's constrained by circumstance. Everybody has constraints on their autonomy to different degrees. There must be some kind of
oppressive restraint on their autonomy.
Right. I wouldn't use the word normal, because I think we want to leave open the door that what is normal could be extremely messed up. It could be extremely oppressive.
Exactly.
Okay. Maybe the best way to contrast it would be someone who is being exploited is someone who is not flourishing, in the sense that they are realizing their own characteristics and qualities, and maybe not necessarily from a purely individualistic point of view, but they're realizing their potential. Is that the kind of thing we're talking about?
Well, what I'm more talking about is situations where you have a system that causes certain groups of people to be exploited more often than certain other groups of people, right?
I think if this doesn't show up in either of the books we read, I don't know that we should spend that much time
Well,
on
the
it.
Reason that I'm interested in it is because I feel a little responsible here, right? Because as you said, this was sort of my decision in terms of the books. And I want to make sure that for our readers that don't necessarily have an exposure to feminism, that they come at least with some understanding of what is it that the Feminist Project is trying to do. And I would say that what the Feminist Project is trying to do is to understand the roots of exploitation and to provide a solution so that women and men can be free of these restraints that we have based on these gender assumptions that we have, but also on the oppressive force of the patriarchy. So this idea that, you know, you have to be competitive, that you have to be in the rat race, that you have to be capitalistic. These can all go into that system. And sometimes what ends up happening is that women are exploited because they're told, well, you're essentially this. For example, you have to be responsible for taking care of the children because women are just better suited to this task. And then the task becomes overwhelming. And I just wanted to make sure that people understood that this is a major component of feminist thinking, is to be concerned with questions of oppression and how do we overcome oppression and, you know, what sorts of paradigms lead to more oppressive thinking.
Well, so Gilman's book would seem to not engage those questions explicitly in terms of characterizing male society or patriarchal society, except through the reluctance of the men in the book to tell them about how awful the rest of the world is compared to her land. Even Terry, the obnoxious thug, is reluctant to do such a thing. He's genuinely embarrassed about the state of outside society.
That's actually one of the great pleasures of the book, right, is that it's a great social commentary. And a lot of those things where the women say, like, so you're saying that women in your society have more children? And it's like, well, actually, only the poor ones, right? And he says, oh, so they have servants to help them. No, actually, the more servants a woman has, the fewer children she has. The style of the book, these three adventurers who are in this land, the women just ask them very reasonable and seemingly innocuous questions about the outside world. And they're embarrassed to answer because they realize, you know, embedded in all of these questions is the exposure of war, hypocrisy, poverty, injustice, all the bad aspects of our society. And they struggle to find ways to articulate the positive aspects of our individualistic, capitalistic society to the women in a way that makes sense to them, that they can understand.
Whether or not Gilman uses the term exploitation, clearly the whole exercise is a reflection that women in her society at the time, and I'm sure she would say today to some extent, are crippled. In both these books, it starts with something that's wrong with the way women's psychology is suppressed or damaged in some way by our current norms. But then it turns out that if you allow the full expression of femininity, or that's not the term, but of women's non-suppressed attitudes, then it exposes something that's just been lost to human nature as well. And so it ends up reforming the whole race and not just women.
Well, Gilman's really explicit about this, right? Because what you would characterize as, you know, the pejorative version of capitalistic society is not represented by every one of those three men. All three of them are very different. All three of them interact with her land in different ways. And so she has a view of at least male psychology that it has a kind of intersection with her land. In fact, 2/3 of the men successfully interact with her land. It's only 1/3 of them that doesn't.
And we should add in the detail, since we're talking about exploitation, that certain strains of feminism see just male-female sexual relations as sort of inherently exploitative. The fact that men have a much larger libido and sort of expect women to fulfill this, and that's shaped a lot of what traditional marriage becomes, and something is seriously wrong with that. Well, the way that shows up in Gilman's novel is, of course, these women have never heard of sex, but each of the men falls in love with one of the women that they meet. In fact, the first three women that they run across at the beginning of the book end up being the ones that they couple with. And so they have these marriage ceremonies, and the women like them too, and they're kind of curious about this.
Well, there's no coupling, right? They get married, right? But there's no sex.
Actually, there's not even coupling in the sense of they don't understand why two people would need private time together.
Exactly. Like,
of course, you need private time yourself, but why would we just need private time, the two of us? And the men are trying to explain this. But then when it comes to actual sex, the women are interested. You know, we've had to rely on this parthenogenesis, but maybe it would be better for us to have sexual reproduction too, to make the gene pool more diverse, make it more healthy. You know, they don't really go into the details here, but they're interested enough to explore it. And so one of them ends up getting somebody pregnant. And so they stick around in the society. Now, the main character, the one he hooks up with, well, she's okay trying it, but then can't understand why he would want to keep doing it again and again and again. That just doesn't make any sense. That's irrational. Maybe this as an experience to get them close together made sense doing it once. But after that, and so he describes this whole thing where his wife here, as far as they, you know, of course, the women don't really understand that term in the way that the men do. The woman is constantly putting him off by gently getting him distracted with other things and is successful about this. He feels that his constant need for sex was something that was immature and that sublimation should be available for this so that men don't feel the need to inflict themselves upon women.
That strain of feminism, just on a human level, I think that rejecting sexual behavior as being inherently exploitative, I don't know. I have a hard time buying that. I guess it's just too much fun for me. I don't know what to tell you. But I do think that the way that men and women relate to each other sexually is obviously context in all sorts of different societal things. And from that perspective, it may be the case that to have genuinely wholesome sexual relationships in a situation of great disparity may be impossible.
Any other reactions from the other folks when you were reading this part of the story? Was this just kind of a something to grin at and not make it? There's no philosophical point here. That, I mean, overall, she's an idealist and she's got this utopian vision, and it becomes very much relief to move to Gilligan, who's dealing with real people in real situations and the way they deal with their choices, as opposed to this imaginary view of what human nature might be under some very exceptional circumstances after a bunch of eugenics. And there's a limited applicability or limits built into that on what her insight into human nature even could be.
going back to something that Seth had said earlier about the way in which there's a kind of typicality of utopian novel. Now, I haven't read a lot of utopias, but I was thinking most about The Republic because it's been on my mind since we did that recently. And there's a kind of bizarre status of sexual relations there, a communality of sexual relations in the sense that the children are part of the community. Sparta had it was this way as well. The women cut their hair very short and they had sex for reproductive purposes, and the children were not part of families in the same way. So I take away from it that in a hyper-socialized society, then sexuality has to be socialized in a certain way and minimized with respect to individuals. So it becomes either, in Gilman's case, it becomes sort of, why do you necessarily have to do that? Or if you're going to do it, it's just sort of like planting the trees. There isn't pleasure involved. There may be enjoyment involved, but it's not done for the sake of pleasure of itself. It's more like the pleasure of planting the seeds to grow the trees, to harvest the fruit kind of pleasure. It makes me wonder about the disposition with respect to things that we take for granted, like physical pleasure, and whether it be in sexuality or in music or in art or things that move the non-rational parts of our souls, that tap into things like jealousy and competition and stuff. Some of that obviously has a very capitalistic, patriarchal edge to it, but I don't know that it always does or always has to. And I wonder about the utter absence of those aspects of a human soul and making it utterly rational in the way it is in Gilman's case, that there's just, it leaves a big question mark for me. The Gilligan doesn't have that question mark because we're dealing with, as Mark said, actual people who are confused, who make choices, who some are exploited, some it's not clear that they're exploited, except maybe in a general way of saying that all women are exploited kind of thing.
I certainly wouldn't necessarily be willing to make that claim. I mean, and as an aside, I think that a lot of men face sexual oppression as well. I've met some men that were wonderful feminists. I've met some women that were wonderful misogynists. And I do think that there were women.
It's true.
They excelled at being misogynists.
Yes.
Or they were wonderful in spite of their misogyny.
I took Azura to mean the former. There are women who are genuine women haters.
Yeah, I think that there are women who are so wrapped up into certain patriarchal thinking that they become the foot soldiers of making sure that those rules are followed. I would say that if you talk to the average woman and you say, when did somebody make you feel like you were dressed in the wrong way, or you were acting in the wrong way, or that you were being inappropriate to gender norm, it'll usually be another woman who's telling you that you're acting inappropriately versus a man.
Who are the people that take the girls for genital mutilation?
It's generally
not the men who hold them down. It's their mothers and their sisters and their aunts that sneak up on them and grab them out of the bed in the middle of the night.
Right. I mean, and it's like that old joke about you never want a TA for a Marxist because those are the ones that put their TAs through the ringer the most.
Oh, that old saw.
Okay, since it fell flat, nobody else had heard it. But that's a joke that I've heard a lot of people say, you know, like, oh, the Marxists, you know, they make their TAs do all the grading and all the teaching and whatever. I mean, I guess what I'm trying to say is, if you think of it in terms of being stuck in a paradigm, there is no reason why, just because I'm born female or I'm born male, I'm going to see the flaws of this paradigm more easily than another person. This is something that you have to study, you have to have some sort of consciousness, or you would just have to have some experiences that cause you to understand, wow, this system is just not working. And so you can have women that are exploiting other women or are furthering values that are exploitative of other women, even as they themselves may feel that they're trying to get ahead. So let's say, for the sake of argument, you know, I'm a corporate lawyer and I have two children, and I hire an immigrant woman to take care of my children, and I hire other immigrant women to take care of my house. And here I am living this awesome lifestyle, but at the same time, I'm living this awesome lifestyle off the backs of these other women who are being exploited. So in that situation, yes, the exploitation is happening by a woman, but that's really sort of irrelevant because she's still stuck in this paradigm. Whereas a man might not be stuck in that paradigm and be an awesome feminist and not be exploitative at all.
I'm interested in tying this part of the conversation and just the conversation in general to Gilligan a bit.
Can we then actually give a quick overview of the book? Since we're now officially making the transition, we can still bring up Gilman some more. So this book by Carol Gilligan, it's got 6 chapters. We read the first 3, the first of which we've talked a little bit about women's place in man's life cycle. It's sort of a review of literature. It talks about Freud, about Piaget, about Lawrence Kohlberg, in particular, this psychologist who Gilligan even did some work with, who had posited this framework for judging moral development. And according to Kohlberg and according to Freud and according to these other theorists she talks about, women were always just judged to be deficient on this, that they didn't achieve a full moral sensibilities, which involve this grasp of abstract justice and things. So it's kind of, if you're looking at it from the point of view of Kant, that you're going from, as a child, this selfishness to wanting to just fit in to actually internalizing to, in Freudian terms, getting the superego in there into an abstract appreciation for doing the right thing and justice. And Kohlberg's scale seemed to have been built on observations of men. And so Gilligan thinks that's a problem. So the point of this book is, what if we look at women in this respect? Can we get some different results? And so chapters 2 and 3 are, 2 is mostly about asking college students about some particular moral dilemmas and what sort of verdicts they yield and how they describe the situation and how they interpret, just how they do moral reasoning in general. And then chapter 3 was this discussion that Dylan alluded to, where this is just a group of women that are having pre-abortion counseling. Is that right? So this is not meant to be a representative sample of the population at all. She's very upfront about that. But it's just asking, you know, what goes into making their decision, and can we draw any conclusions based on that about what constitutes healthy moral development in women as opposed to some sort of deficiency?
That's a fine overview. I read a version that came out in 1992, which included a long preface by Gilligan, which was pretty interesting in itself. And she has, as a kind of overview statement from her, at the beginning of that preface, I'll just read this paragraph. She says, "In listening to people's responses to In a Different Voice, I often hear the two-step process, which I went through over and over again in the course of my writing. The process of listening to women and hearing something new, a different way of speaking, and then hearing how quickly this difference gets assimilated into old categories of thinking so that it loses its novelty and its message. Is it nature or nurture? Are women better than men, or worse? When I hear my work being cast in terms of whether women and men are really essentially different, or who is better than whom, I know that I have lost my voice, because these are not my questions. Instead, my questions are about our perceptions of reality and truth, how we know, how we hear, how we see, how we speak. My questions are about voice and relationship, and my questions are about psychological processes and theory, particularly theories in which men's experience stands for all human experience, theories which eclipse the lives of women and shut out women's voices. I saw that by maintaining these ways of seeing and speaking about human lives, men are leaving out women, but women were leaving out themselves. In terms of psychological processes, what for men was a process of separation, for women was a process of dissociation that required the creation of an inner division or psychic split. That dissociation is part of what she really tries to get to in those interviews, is the idea that there are different voices that each person has, and that one thing that happens with women, besides having maybe in general women having a kind of different voice than men in general, for a number of reasons, that voice, regardless, gets suppressed. And maybe the word exploited would come in there. Gilligan doesn't use that word, as I recall. So I guess for me, what I was interested in reading the Gilligan was the idea of the different psychological processes that men and women go through and what that difference meant.
Should we give the Heinz example from chapter 2 here, which seems to take up a large portion of the discussion?
Sure.
So men and women are given this example to analyze, which is a guy's wife is dying of some disease. This pharmacist has the medicine, but because the guy doesn't have the money to pay for it, the pharmacist says, no, you can't have it. What should the guy do? Steal the medicine because for utilitarian reasons? Well, it's left open-ended. And just as important as what they choose, I mean, almost everybody says, yeah, of course the guy should steal the medicine or something. But the reasons given by the various participants were very different, right?
Yes.
The men, in keeping with this picture of male morality as based on abstractions like Kant or appreciation for human rights or utilitarian calculations. Almost all of the versions we've considered so far in our past episodes, apart from Hume, who is seen as an early feminist, interestingly, all these involve these sort of abstractions. And so that's what a lot of the men in this study seem to look at. But according to at least some of the women here, and it's a slightly greater percentage of women than men, used language that was more in terms of the relationships involved, right? Mm-hmm. He should steal it because it was mean for that pharmacist to do that. And where does that pharmacist get off? The guy loves his wife. He wouldn't be able to live with himself if he didn't help her. And even though he might go to jail, that's just a risk he's going to be willing to take. You know, it seemed that some of the women in the study wanted to contextualize it more. This whole idea of asking these abstract moral quandaries are that they're abstract, and that a lot of the women in their moral reasoning out loud were filling in details. As Pat Churchland said in our last episode, again, being very influenced by Hume, that maybe just considering these rules in the abstract and how they apply to a given situation is not the right way to go. You need to consider the relationships and the situation in their concrete fullness. And there's no a priori rules that are going to tell you which way to go. It's going to be a judgment call based on your own feelings about the matter. And so if you don't have human feelings, you're not going to be able to do moral reasoning. It's not just a matter of reflecting on these abstract moral rules.
Well, in a specific example given for the women was that the choice was made complicated by the question, well, if you steal it, then you might get caught and you might go to jail and then you won't be able to take care of her anyway. And that kind of answer was relatively common for the women. That's what Gilligan characterizes as relationship thinking, as opposed to the sort of calculation that was more typical of the males. And this was true regardless of whether they were young or older.
Right. So Amy is the little girl, and along with Jake, you know, she gives her own explanation of the Heinz dilemma. And there's this whole idea that not only is she concerned with keeping the relationships, but she's also concerned with the story over time, which is part of the other context. So whereas yep. Jake sees this as a math problem, but with people that is static and uncontext, she sees it as taking place over a long period of time. So she's concerned with, well, what are going to be the ramifications of this action in the sense of, will he be able to continue taking care of her? Really, she thinks that the best answer is for the husband to sit down with the pharmacist and just explain the situation again. And she really thinks that if the pharmacist comes to understand the genuine need that the wife has and the importance of the wife, then they can figure something out, like a payment plan, or maybe he can borrow the money from someone. And so she's trying to come up with all of these different solutions that rely on other relationships that don't sever the relationship to the pharmacist, because she thinks that the relationship with the pharmacist is important going forward as well.
But nobody suggests that he poisoned the pharmacist's wife and then propose a group discount or something like that. None of that.
No, Mark.
It's not, doesn't go no, that far into
nobody suggests that.
Now, notice that, you know, you were the one who brought up the violent language.
Yes, right. That was another, in one of the first two chapters, where they just show kids pictures that are ambiguous and rate how many times the men versus the women used violent imagery to describe them.
And make up and stories, yes, make men, up stories for them.
Right. And the men were much more likely to put that in there.
One of the striking ones was, one of the pictures was of two sets of hands, one holding the other on a trapeze. So it was just a picture of the hands. And my recollection is that it was overwhelmingly the case that not all of them, but many more of the male respondents had a story associated with that picture that involved the violent death of the one being held up. And it might have been a mistake, or there might be some kind of interesting backstory, but nonetheless, someone dies. And for the women, the stories involved were about, I don't know, saving people and holding on and stuff like that.
Well, and the women also put in safety nets.
That's right.
There was even one story that was about two trapeze artists who were asked to do it without a safety net and refused because they decided that it wasn't worth the danger to their act to do so.
Yep.
So where the men are engaged in all of, I thought the story about, I think it was Nick who writes the short story about the picture of the two people sitting next to the river. And he imagines that there's a third person drowning in the river and that the two are the jealous lovers who are watching him die.
So much of that has to do with getting into issues of people's relationship toward humor and what do they consider humor, and does that reflect their anxieties? So it's not necessarily men like violence, and so they're more likely to tell these kind of stories, but maybe more men, if they have to amuse themselves by making up a story, are going to try to not do a romance. They're going to do something that makes them laugh. And one of the things that makes us laugh is, well, maybe more men than women, but anything that we're uncomfortable with, like getting hit by lightning or what, any violence involved. So to me, that experiment by itself did not convince me, other than just the obvious, yes, boys are more into playing that involves violence than girls. But don't we already know that?
Oh, but so you're making the point, Mark, that the fact that they were making stories self-consciously is an important aspect of it, and that the psychological analysis of that has to include the story-making part of it, and that it might not reflect their actual activity, say, in a given situation.
Sure. I mean, it's uncontroversial that men tend, on average, to be more violent than women. Just look at the percentage of violent criminals of the various sexes. I just don't want to mix these issues together. There's a lot of complexity here, I think. So I found the discussions of the Heinz dilemma and the interviews with women contemplating abortion much more revealing of something new and interesting here than this description of the people's reaction to the pictures.
Yeah. If I could just say one more thing about the pictures. I thought it was interesting that the women were more likely to depict violence in the picture that had one person isolated, whereas she pointed out that the men were more likely to depict violence in the situation where the people were touching. And there is something to be said for women are raised to have to not be alone, and that if there's any sort of dangerous situation, you have to be escorted. So I remember, for example, a time that I had a friend who was talking about how they wanted to escort her back to her car at the end of her work shift. And she said, you know, I'm 6 foot and I'm strong and I'm a martial artist. I just didn't understand. And then a little bit later, she said, and you know, when I was a boy, nobody ever offered to walk me back to my car. Meaning that I think that there is this idea that we try to protect women from violent situations. We try to make sure that women are separated from violent situations. And we also tell women over and over that you shouldn't be alone, because situations in which you're alone are likely to be potentially dangerous.
And so this is the culture of safe walk, not the culture of what Freud is pointing at. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
So Freud's got this picture, male independence, right? They start with the Oedipus complex, and attaining maturity is achieving separation, is breaking away from the mother. Whereas for women, there are different things that happen, and it's not necessary for them to break away from this key relationship. One of the chapters in here is called Visions of Maturity. And if your standard of maturity is having this separation, then yeah, women are not going to measure up in the same way, because that's just not the way they're raised. So Gilligan, though she doesn't like the characterization of the female as deficient by Freud and these other folks, admits that there's a difference. That's the whole point of the different voice.
Whether there is a human nature, then you would want to ask, well, are there differences of human nature? Does difference develop into genuinely different beings? So if you have genuine difference, then are they different things? And if they are, then how are they related? The question of difference goes back to the question of relation, that if you have things that are relatable, then how different are they? And if they are genuinely different, then how are they relatable?
I want to go back to this Heinz example. The thing that struck me about this was her discussion about how the boy, Jake, has a calculus, right? Where he says essentially, screw the pharmacist, because whatever the amount of money is that he's going to lose, it's not equivalent to a human life. And I think a judge would agree with me, right? Isn't that one of his lines, that he feels like if he went to court, he would have a justification for his action? And the girl, Amy, right, she's interested in the context. And what's interesting about what Gilligan points out about this is that the situation as it's constructed by the interrogator, right, because Gilligan's also concerned to talk about the way that the person who's asking the question asks the questions and how he pursues it. But the simplified sort of moral dilemma is always sufficient for the boy, but the girl always wants more context. She always wants to understand more, what are the specifics of the situation, and what about the relationship between, and what about the future state, and what about this, and what about that. Gilligan's concerned to make a point about the way in which males and females essentially approach moral dilemmas. And I wanted to tie that back to the Gilman in the sense that Gilman society, this utopian society, her view of it, even though you might be able to look at it and say, oh, well, this is really a socialist utopia, etc., it's still constructed in such a way that there's this rational analysis of the full context of the situation with regard for the future and the possibilities and the relationships between all the people and the decisions that they make about how they're going to move the society forward or how they're going to structure the society are based on considerations that still align very closely with what Gilligan describes as this female gender-specific approach to moral problems and not so much the male approach. So I did see a level of consistency there between the two, mm-hmm. even though you might read the Gilman to be talking about socialism, and then you get off on the topic of rationality and reason, which is a whole nother issue. There still was that bit that I thought they sort of connected on.
That sounds right.
That is absolutely on target in terms of what Gilman was doing.
What do we want to say about the abortion interviews?
I don't want to talk about those. It's going to take us too far.
Well, we should say what the replacement that Gilligan gave for Kohlberg's theory of moral development, right? Which is this progression to an appreciation for abstract justice or something like that, that the female version of this was starting out like the men in this selfish survival mode. But then instead of the second phase being trying to conform with whatever the society's rules are, it turns straight to altruism. And this maybe turns on women's exploitation, that the way that women interpret going along with the crowd is not obeying some code like men might, but be giving of yourself because that's what society is expecting of women. Just squash what you want and do what I'm asking of you. And then for the mature final stage for Gilligan, it's a matter of realizing that I'm a person too, and my needs need to be taken into account too, and sort of finding yourself, reasserting yourself, not becoming selfish again or something, but rather getting rid of the whole selfish, selfless dichotomy and seeing that caring for others is legitimate and caring for yourself is legitimate, and that it becomes a balancing act between these two things. And again, there's no easy formula to apply that's going to resolve individual situations. It becomes this inelimitably complex, and I'm putting this in a way, again, that sounds very much like the way Churchland was talking in our last episode, when you're thinking of particular situations and you just have to take into account all the individuals involved and their individual needs and the circumstances and do some hard thinking. And that seemed to be what in the abortion interviews, what the kind of maturity as people were progressing, she was seeing more of. That the less mature people weren't taking responsibility for the choice being theirs at all, or for being in the relationship or being in the situation where they would be getting pregnant or any of that stuff. And as they attained more of a sense of self and thought that they didn't just have to do what other people told them to do, then this was the positive step. This was the trajectory that she was able to glean from these interviews.
Because I read this the second time on a Kindle and they don't have freaking regular page numbers in it, I can't tell you where in chapter 3 it is. But there's this long paragraph where it seems to me she summarizes a lot of the lesson learned from these interviews. She says, the moral imperative that emerges repeatedly in interviews with women is an injunction to care, a responsibility to discern and alleviate the, quote, real and recognizable trouble, unquote, of this world. For men, the moral imperative appears rather as an injunction to respect the rights of others and thus to protect from interference the rights to life and self-fulfillment. Women's insistence on care is at first self-critical rather than self-protective, while men initially conceive obligation to others negatively in terms of non-interference. Development for both sexes would therefore seem to entail an integration of rights and responsibilities through the discovery of the complementarity of these disparate views. For women, the integration of rights and responsibilities takes place through an understanding of the psychological logic of relationships. This understanding tempers the self-destructive potential of a self-critical morality by asserting the need of all persons for care. For men, recognition through experience of the need for more active responsibility in taking care corrects the potential indifference of a morality of non-interference and turns attention from the logic to the consequences of choice. In the development of a post-conventional ethical understanding, women come to see the violence inherent in inequality, while men come to see the limitations of a conception of justice blinded by the differences in human life.
Blinded to
the differences. Thank you, Mark, for correcting my prepositions.
It makes a difference, actually.
It makes a huge difference. A kind of hyper-rationalistic view of morality tends towards a kind of hyper-universalism where you then make everybody the same. There are no contingencies. There's no context. There's no special circumstance. And that's sort of the extreme case of all human beings are one kind of being. And then on the other end, you would have a kind of radical contextualism in which every human being is utterly different from every individual human being, that there is nothing genuinely relatable about them. And those would sort of be the polar opposite. Each individual human is an instance of a being that is not relatable, that's utterly different. And then you have, of course, a big span in between. Gilligan seems to put women in a concern for care that has to do with preserving relationships by changing the rules, and men with giving up relationships but preserving the rules. Just those two differences lead to a different, whether they're male or female or not, I think is probably, it's not beside the point for Gilligan, but they certainly represent two different ways of understanding morality.
Yeah, that's the way I ended up reading this, as being something about a commentary of different approaches to ethics, as opposed to when I was reading some of the online commentary about Gilligan. I mean, Gilligan says here, look, this is not a representative sample. It's not been clearly scientifically established that there really is this much greater adherence to care language in women than men. It seems like both kinds, the abstract morality language and the care language, occur in both sexes. Clearly, they're both things that are percolating around our culture. And I guess to me, it doesn't matter, because ultimately these insights that are supposed to appear when we strip away the looking purely at men or purely at white men in a particular culture become to the benefit of us all. And there's some generalizations you can make about this is the way men are and this is the way women are. But like you were saying in your quote from her new introduction to this book, Dylan, that's not really her point. Right? That in a different voice is not just the monolithic female voice being different than the monolithic male voice, but really opening things up to some sort of pluralism.
I think that's right. But I think that it would be disingenuous to say that she isn't in the work focused on studying women for a reason.
Yes.
It isn't a case where she's immediately leaping to some kind of transgender understanding.
Well, but that's the way the end of that quote that you just read is that, look, once we realize this, then we realize how men who have only achieved the ideal of a Kantian rationalist view on morality are actually themselves not fully morally mature. They need to incorporate this other part as well. And likewise, women, maybe there's a different trajectory, but ultimately all this stuff is to the human good. These both ways of thinking about morality are, you sort of need them both for a complete comprehensive, mature view.
Yeah, that sounds right.
Okay, so one of the critiques of Gilligan that comes up a lot is whether she's trying to make this as a claim that is essentialist. And I don't think she's trying to make this as a claim that's essentialist at all. I think she's talking about women in an American context. And one of the things that I would point out is that in general, women are engaged in care work more often than men are. So if we think about caring as a practice, then it would make sense that if women are engaged in this practice more often, that it's going to change the way that they then view the world. You know, in the same way that a physician is going to look at you differently than an engineer, a caretaker is going to look at you differently than a capitalist, for example. So men, by not being allowed access to this care work, are being denied a certain type of moral thinking as well.
This is such a massive topic. It's really difficult and unfair to try to approach it. First off, I would say to the listeners, the Wikipedia entry on feminist philosophy is not even worth reading. It's what they would define as a stub if they bothered to do the work to actually look at it. The Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy has a slightly better entry.
Well, they have several entries. They have one on just feminist ethics
and feminist moral psychology,
and I found that pretty valuable.
Yeah, they have multiple entries about specific areas, but if you just do the feminist philosophy one, it was written by somebody at Penn State, I think. It does a pretty good job of kind of laying out some high-level stuff. But one of the things that when Mark and I were talking about this, Jesus, what was it, a year and a half ago? I mean, it's been forever we've been trying to do this episode, is that so much of what we understand as, let's call it feminist philosophy, requires an understanding and a knowledge of specific philosophers or the tradition or themes in philosophy that we felt like we couldn't read a lot of this stuff. For example, Lucia Rigore, right? You can't read her without reading Nietzsche. You can't read Kristeva without knowing something about
Derrida, Lacan.
It goes on and on, right? It's like it was too complicated a topic to kind of approach for our subject matter. And that's why we turned to Azura, was to try to get some help. And what you see is we didn't even pick a philosophical readings. Gilligan's work is an exercise in scholarship. It's a standard text, but it wasn't just like a movement of the period. I mean, this was a meaningful and significant book in academia and in scholarship. I think it holds up quite well. And yet you see this discussion. There's so many different threads. There's so many issues that open up. It's very hard to stay focused. It's been hard for me to stay focused. I wish there was an easier entry point.
My impression is that the easier entry points are all crap. Like if you were to read, and I don't have any names in mind here, but I mean, just the kind of discussions that people tend to just get into, you know, are men really different than women? How unproductive are those discussions usually? There's so many individual insights you can stumble on, but they don't turn into anything systematic and philosophical. And I liked both of these readings, especially the Gilligan, as a way of saying something concrete and real and measurable about an observed difference in particular interviews. And what are we to make of that? And how this constitutes a challenge to a lot of specific scholars in this specific area. And then once you've got that in, then you can sort of see how you might make similar critiques. We'd have to read something else. What is a feminist epistemology? What is a feminist metaphysics? All this talk of substances, that's so manly, and women wouldn't come up with the concept of substance. They would be more process-oriented. I don't know. It goes in a lot of different directions.
You're absolutely right.
This at least stayed very sane.
I agree. I mean, and just to mark on that point, like if you buy what Gilligan says, and it's hard not to, and you look at Herland and you think of it as kind of like a literary articulation of some of these themes, you can call into question the whole social contract enterprise. Or you can go back and you can say, oh, guess what? Rousseau was feminine and Locke and Hobbes were masculine or something. There's a lot of different ways to go with this that are really, really interesting. I don't know, man. I want to know more. I want to talk about it more. But it's tough.
It is tough. I mean, and I think that there's something to be said for, too, in terms of myself and the things that I was trying to say. I'm obviously reacting against a lot of positions and a lot of different movements. So on one hand, I'm trying to just have a conversation about feminism. But on the other hand, you sort of have to tread lightly for all of these minds that the listeners may not be aware are there. I don't want to fall into any sort of essentialist trap and say that I think that women inherently are more caring than men, or that women inherently are more likely to think about things in a certain way. But I do think that the way that men and women experience the world is different. And having these different experiences leads us to naturally think about things a little bit differently. For me, the goal is for us to come up with a way to basically be able to have all of the different types of human experiences that we want and not be limited by our gender in having those experiences. And I think that Gilligan does a really good job of saying, look, if you have had the kinds of experiences that women have in this society, in this current time, then these experiences lead you to look at the world differently. I thought the example of the story where the physician finds out that she's at the top of her class, and where the women looked at this as something that was a little bit more negative or potentially chancy, whereas the guys all thought, well, she's at the top of her class, that's great. Now, one way to look at that is to say, well, women don't want to be in competition. Another way to look at that is to say, maybe there is something in our society which actively discourages women from winning competitions. You know, if you've had enough experiences of coming in number one and then being isolated socially later, or whatever the negative might be, then you may decide, you know, I'd rather lie low and not have that sort of exposure. And it may not be for the reasons that Gilligan is talking about. It may be for reasons that have more to do with how women experience success, which is something that she also discusses as well.
See, maybe the male reaction to this presentation is that now we have to solve the abstract conflict between nature and nurture, that we need to figure out whether these differences that Gilligan observed are essential due to some biological matter, or whether it's a matter of socialization, like you said. And if we had a society where men were not oppressing women, then we would not see these differences. Whereas I feel like Gilligan has already told us that she doesn't want things to snap back into looking at this new information through these old paradigms, or rather, like the women in encountering the moral situations, we don't want to just break it down to some abstract categories like nature and nurture and try to figure those out in the abstract. We just need to consider the concrete situation of women as it is in this society or whatever society the writer happens to be in. And how do we deal with that? It only matters what is nature versus what is nurture insofar as we're trying to come up with remedies for this. So, you know, let's try to fix the social conditions and then we'll see what's left, or we'll learn about these things sort of in the course of our dealing with the concrete complexity of the situation, not by backing off and having some sort of abstract philosophical argument about abstract terms.
The only reason I brought up the nature and nurture was just because I think that a lot of times when women say, I want things to be different, they hear this rejoinder of, but women are essentially X. And I think if you look at the historical record, when women have been told women are essentially X, that's eventually been shattered. You know, we're now seeing that the record holders for, you know, the Olympic 100 meter dash and things like that, that the difference between the men and the women is getting smaller and smaller as we're now figuring out how to train women more properly. So if you say to a woman, well, you just can't run because women are not going to be runners, then of course she's not going to try. That's the only reason that I want to bring it up, is to just say that personally, I fall on nurture more so because I think that that's something that we can change. But then when people fall into the essentialist nature trap, then they just say, well, you know, this is just the way the women are. They're irrational. They're unreliable. For whatever reason, they're just not going to be able to compete.
Well, Azura, I'm sorry to tell you, though, you're just not going to win the biggest penis competition, however hard you try.
Well, okay. Well, Gilligan has a great comment about this issue of gender differences and biologically versus socially constructed that I guess I'm obsessed with quoting tonight, but I want to read this one as well. She says, I find the question of whether gender differences are biologically determined or socially constructed to be deeply disturbing. This way of posing the question implies that people, women and men alike, are either genetically determined or a product of socialization, that there is no voice, and without voice there is no possibility for resistance, for creativity, or for a change whose wellsprings are psychological. At its most troubling, the present reduction of psychology either to sociology or biology or some combination of the two prepares the way for the kind of control that alarmed Hannah Arendt and George Orwell, the hand over the mouth and at the throat, the suffocation of voice and the deadening of language which ripen the conditions for fascism and totalitarian rule, the psychic numbing which is associated with that now curiously unspoken word, propaganda. The thing I like about that is...
Besides that, she's a great writer. It's very mellifluous.
Yes. What I like about that is it accentuates another of the words in the title of the book, which is voice, which is the notion of each person being an individual actor that has an activity of their own, and I guess implied with that a moral status to it. And in her case, it implies a self-motion that is not wholly determined by either nature or nurture, or even just a combination of those two things. That from her perspective, you're missing a huge part of the boat if you forget the fact that individual people are active entities, that they aren't determined by some combination of nature versus nurture. That I find very interesting and very satisfying, and in concert with the rest of her book. I like that very much.
That sounds like a closing. Who else has a closing? Not willing to close down, other than there's too many issues here. Is that your closing?
That's my closing.
I feel bad, Seth, that you feel so despondent about the discussing the topic.
Despondent is not the right word.
Well, I don't mean despondent in the sense that you don't like it. I mean despondent in the sense of at a loss for approaching it in any measure successfully.
No, I don't think that's the case. I guess what I would say is maybe this is one of those things where we picked a very broad scope, and given our format, it's very difficult to treat it appropriately. Maybe it requires some additional discussion or a different way of segmenting. Unfortunately, as is evidenced by both the Wikipedia entry and Mark's point about the Stanford Encyclopedia, maybe we should have done a podcast on feminist moral philosophy or psychology or feminist epistemology or something along those lines and narrowed the scope a little bit. But if we had done that, we would have missed out on the opportunity of reading both of these great books, which I highly recommend to the listeners.
Well, sounds like a call for a second podcast.
Yeah. Maybe.
I would also change the rule, right? I would say that it's not necessarily have to be constrained by the idea that this was a podcast about feminism, but just like all the other podcasts, you read a book, right? And you talk about that. These were a good pair, I thought.
I thought they were an excellent pair. Yes. I agree with that. What I felt constrained about was like using these two texts as a lever to talk about feminist philosophy, and I got caught up in the concept of what was feminist philosophy. But I thoroughly enjoyed Herland for both the style, the wit, the social commentary and criticism, as well as the ideas. And Gilligan, this took me back to when I was bright-eyed and bushy-tailed and optimistic about the future and participating in a humanities program. This is just to share an anecdote. The first year of college I went to, I graduated from Reed, but the first year of school I did was at a place called Occidental, which is in Los Angeles. And it was funded by, I think, the Occidental Petroleum Corporation or something like that. But it's another small liberal arts school. It just happens to be near Eagle Rock in Los Angeles. And I was part of some sort of honors program or something like that there. And the year I did was this whole year of broad-based humanities. We did things like part of the curriculum was we had to write fiction or do a piece of art, and we had to do like volunteer work at a clinic. There's a whole bunch of stuff involved, but this was one of the texts I read as part of this program, and it had a pretty profound impact on me. You know, I was 19, first year of school, encountering all of these new ideas, and this was really, really, really a significant work in my life. And so I embraced the opportunity to sort of revisit it 20 years later, 24 years later. Jesus Christ, 24 years. This is getting very personal, so I'll just let it go. But this wasn't just like another reading for me. It was like nostalgia combined with significant academic work, combined with very heavy and interesting and important ideas.
It sounds like you and Dylan were much more sensitive college males than I was.
Seth, I think I understand where you're coming from in a lot of the things that you said, especially about the entry point. Because I mean, I was really scratching my head trying to come up with a good initial book and that would allow us to discuss these themes in the way that they're meant to be discussed. And I think that this conversation was really great and I really enjoyed it. And I'm really glad that I got to read these books. But there is something to be said for feeling, you know, I had this really great meal and yet I'm still having a craving for cheesecake, even though I had pecan pie, that may or may not be how you were feeling.
Are you saying you have an eating disorder? Is that what you're saying? Listeners, if you thought this was great and it makes you hungry for pecan pie, then you should go to our blog, partiallyexaminedlife.com, and demand another feminism episode, and maybe in a year we'll get around to it. Thanks, yeah. Azura, for gracing us with your presence and for recommending these readings. It's just great to have you on and hear your thoughts on this.
Thank you. It was lovely to be here.
Thanks to the listeners and to you, Seth and Dylan. I want to also thank some recent donors. We have Ernest Prabhakar, Sean Holly, Leigh Ann Shearer. I'm sure I mispronounced all three of those, but you can be like those people and perhaps have me mispronounce your name if you go to our website, partiallyexaminedlife.com, and donate a little cash to us. Another way of doing things, if you're ordering stuff from Amazon anyway, go to one of our Amazon ads on our site. You know, whenever we name a book, pretty much it's a link to an Amazon page. And it is tagged with us, and we'll get like 5% of your purchase price. Even if it's not that item, you can just go there and buy anything. So do all your Christmas shopping, and it won't cost you anything extra. Next time, proofs for or against the existence of God. Our guide through this is J.L. Mackey, who wrote a book called The Miracle of Theism. That's kind of like a philosophy's greatest hits, and he goes through all the different versions of the classic arguments by your favorite medieval philosophers and Descartes and Hume and Berkeley and all the rest of them. So we are reading chapters 1 through 3, 5 through 6, 8, and 11 in that book. Read partiallyexaminedlife.com. You'll get a lot of follow-up information related to topics brought up in this discussion, some related works, some things maybe we didn't get around to. We'll try to get Azura to blog a little, maybe.
Yeah.
As well as you guys, Dylan. We also have a Facebook group. We have Twitter. Go to the iTunes store and give us a nice review, a nice star rating, whatever. And
Good night,
everybody.
Good night.
I'm trying to think of all I want to say to you and how to show you how important you are to me. The words never do justice to a lifetime of getting through. I want to thank you more than I can breathe. I hope you know how much you're loved, and I hope you know how much you've done, and I hope you know what effect you've had to make me what I. Fit in my big mouth, 100 years could pass, it's not enough. I'm so very grateful for the time we're given. I've known you half your whole life, it's not enough. I want you to stay where you are, not more than forever by far. I hope you know how much you're loved, and I hope you know how much you've done, and I hope you know what effect you've had to make me what I am. And I want you to stay where you are, not more than forever by far.
See you again.